It's Friday, November 12, 2010. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Americans have been fascinated by the account of the Carnival Splendor, a ship with 4,500 passengers and crew that was for several days this week stranded off the coast of Mexico. This giant luxury liner, we now know, was filled with people who had intended to take a cruise as a vacation, but ended up with something very different. Because off the coast of Mexico, a fire disabled the engine and shut down most of the power and the energy to the ship that led to several days of disastrous experience for those who had been going, after all, for a luxurious cruise. The accounts that came off the cruise ship included the fact that naval and military sources had to get food to the people there on the passenger liner, even as, at least for a considerable period of time, the running toilets had broken down, and there was no electricity, no air conditioning, and no lighting, especially in internal cabins. We're talking about 4,500 people here. Most Americans looking at this situation would actually recoil in horror, thinking of few things that would be more unbearable than being on a ship with 4,500 people surrounded by darkness and stench, a lack of sewage, and a lack of food. But what came out of the story from these who had been on this cruise liner was that after the original disequilibrium of trying to figure out how exactly they were going to get through these days, something like a new normal appeared amongst those who were trapped aboard the ship. Now, from a Christian perspective, this is really interesting. According to Thomas Hobbes and many of the other philosophers of human nature from a secular perspective, when this kind of incident happens, you should expect a total breakdown of order. But that didn't happen. People started taking care of each other. They found a sense of humor and found a way to get through this together. And when they arrived at that port in San Diego and disembarked, they did not do so bloodied and bruised, but rather, frankly, just relieved to be off of that ship. Christians have a very important category for this, and it's called common grace or restraining grace. We understand that God actually has implanted within human beings a conscience to restrain us even when there is a breakdown of order and the kind of uncomfortable disaster that appeared on the horizon of those who had taken a cruise only to end up being trapped on a cruise ship. Yesterday, we talked about Amazon.com and the controversy that emerged there, the largest book-selling site on the internet, over a title that was available as an ebook, at least through yesterday, entitled The Pedophile's Guide to Love and Pleasure, A Child Lover's Code of Conduct. Now, this particular book is absolutely reprehensible, and it has a real-life author who put his own name on the book and who gave an interview to CNN. Philip R. Greaves said that true pedophiles love children and would never hurt them. Now, yesterday, Amazon.com has stood by its policy of saying that removing the book would amount to censorship. Well, evidently they got over the policy because the book is now no longer available. I had predicted that social pressure would lead to this inevitable result, but is it not interesting to note that when you look at this kind of outrage, Americans now operate on a selective sexual moral outrage. Pedophilia is now, and we should be thankful for this, clearly considered outside the pale. But Americans have found a way to reconcile their consciences with many other forms of what the Bible considers to be sexual sin. This is another warning to us that sins can be negotiated away one by one. The Washington Post has become the latest of the major American newspapers in noting an uptick in the number of American couples who are cohabitating. Jeremy Olson, writing for the Washington Post, introduces us to a couple, Jessica Peltier and her boyfriend, who look like a married couple. They live together, drive their three-year-old daughter to dance class at the YMCA, and bicker over laundry or empty cans sitting around. The only thing missing, it seems, is the marriage. Now, here's what Ms. Peltier said. We plan on getting married when money permits. Now, what kind of statistical uptick are we talking about here? Well, census researchers indicate that the current population survey showed an increase of cohabitating couples from 6.7 million in 2009 to 7.5 million in 2010. You get that right. That's an uptick of 800,000 cohabitating couples in a matter of just 1 year. The statisticians were absolutely concerned that this could be an anomaly or a mistake, but when they tracked the data, it was backed up. There really has been, according to the Census Bureau, a significant uptick in American couples who are cohabitating, living together without benefit of marriage. Now, the Washington Post, as well as so many others in the media, have bought into the idea that this has to be about money. It's about money because the people who are telling us why they're cohabitating are telling us that it's about the money. But no one's really asking the more basic question. How is it that people who had even less in times past, who by any kind of econometric understanding actually were operating on a lower standard of living, found their way to getting married? Why is it that getting married these days seems to be so expensive? Is it the wedding? Well, on the part of some people, it turns out when you scratch beneath the surface, the wedding is an issue. That's one of the reasons why our idolatry of the wedding has become an obstacle to the morality of marriage. But for many others, it's really not about the wedding. It's really about being married. And thus, the closer we look at that equation, it looks like a moral fig leaf. It's hard to imagine that economics is really what's at stake here. Well, what we have is the marginalization of marriage. Added to that, we have the legitimation of non-marital heterosexual lifestyles. This significant uptick is a very important moral signal to us. The year 1910 is unlikely to be the last year of that uptick, regardless of what happens in the economy. Other news related to the family was reported by the New York Times in the fact that an increasing number of American children are living with grandparents. Sabina Tavernise reports the number of children living in their grandparents' home increased by 8% compared to 2009, the second such rise in 2 years, and an indication that the recession is arranging how people live. Now, looking at this data and at the arguments, it appears that economic issues really do play more of a part here. Overall, 6.5% of children in the United States lived with their grandparents, a 20-year high, and double the rate from 1970. Now, that's interesting, too. A part of what has happened in the modern world is that the family has been drawn apart from its larger structures, in particular the extended family, made up of kin, of grandparents, of aunts and uncles and cousins and all the rest. That has become a matter of reunion rather than of communal location for the family. Families are generally split apart. The mobilization of families in terms of mobility, moving them around the nation job after job, cause after cause, has led to the breakdown of many of these family ties. The separation of children from their grandparents comes at a significant cost. Grandparents actually have an important role to play in the lives of children, and that's not by accident. Remember that the Christian worldview is not just about the family that is isolated in one generation. It's rather, in the context of both testaments, a transgenerational vision of perpetuating faithfulness from generation to generation to generation. Grandparents have a lot to add in the lives of children. There is significant loss here when both parents have to work outside the home and the children are left with the grandparents by a sense of emergency. That we need to concede right off. But retying the bonds between grandparents and grandchildren, that, just taken on its own terms, is a good thing. Protests on the streets of England are likely to become a sign of things to come. These riots were particularly in London, where students were protesting, in protests that turned violent, an increase in tuition to be charged to students in British universities. Now, the background of this is really pretty interesting, because throughout most of the history of the British university, British citizens paid no tuition whatsoever. That changed in the 1990s under the Labour government, when that government began to charge tuition. And here's the principle you need to keep in mind. Once you start charging tuition, any institution becomes largely tuition-dependent, and at some point that tuition is going to rise to rather uncomfortable levels. That's what's happening in Great Britain. The immediate cause of this is the breakdown of the British economy and the fact that the British government, that had been so overspending for so many years, has had to make draconian cuts in order to bring the budget into a new pattern of fiscal responsibility. Others might call it austerity. Now, what we see in this tuition controversy and in these riots is a basic denial of reality. We need to admit something right off. Education is expensive. It's unbelievably expensive. It is personnel intensive, and over the last several years, it has become even more expensive and is likely to do so in the future as well. We're going to have to rethink the whole equation of education. We're going to have to rethink the roles of colleges and universities and the expectation that a college or university education at any cost is what people need in order to be trained and prepared for the new economy and for meaningful work. Education is important. College and university degrees will continue to be important. But on both sides of the Atlantic, students are going to have to start measuring the cost of their education over against anticipated income and making adequate financial as well as academic decisions. No riot in the streets is going to prevent that kind of crisis from coming to pass. Columnist George Will wrote an interesting piece looking at the political and social developments of the last year, and he remarks about something that ought to have our attention. When you look at labor members, that is, members of labor unions in the United States, we need to note that a significant shift has taken place. Today, the majority of those who are members of a labor union are actually public sector employees, not private sector employees. So the idea that Americans have of labor unions, basically as an important check on the power of corporations, is really out of date. The majority of these union members are working for us, for the federal government, and that changes the entire labor equation. Remember that the next time you hear about labor unions. A major advance in the cultural recognition of electronic books, that's the kind of book that's read on a Kindle or an iPad or the like, is reflected in the fact that the New York Times is now going to rank ebook bestsellers along with other forms of print publication starting early next year. Writing for the Times, Julie Bosman explains that this is due to the fact that there's been such a significant increase in the number of ebooks sold and in the recognition of the role of ebooks as a growth area within the field of publishing. As she reports, ebook sales have risen steeply in 2010, spurred by the growing popularity of the Amazon Kindle and by the release of the Apple iPad in April. According to the Association of American Publishers, which receives sales data from publishers, ebook sales in the first 9 months of 2010 were $304 million, up from $105 million in the same period in 2009, a nearly 190% increase. End quote. Now, a 190% increase in any commercial field is absolutely remarkable. This tells us that the ebook is here to stay. I myself have read a couple of books this week as ebooks on my Kindle or Kindle application on the iPad. Is the iPad or is the Kindle going to replace the book in printed form? No, I certainly don't believe so. I still read most of my books the old-fashioned way, and that is as paper between covers. But the ebook is here to stay because it fulfills a very important function. There are some books I don't need on my shelf. There are some books I can read on a Kindle or an iPad and do so profitably. This week, you'll remember, was marked in publishing history by the release of George W. Bush's presidential memoir, Decision Points. Well, I was able to get that book overnight in an e-form long before the bookstores opened and to start reading the book even before, well, the bookstore opened and I could get a print copy. Well, starting early next year, by looking at the New York Times in terms of bestsellers, we'll find out what people are reading on ebooks. That'll tell us something about the future of publishing. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. On Thursday, I led a discussion amongst faculty members in Southern Seminary's chapel about the 25th anniversary of Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. I'll talk more about that later, but you can hear that panel discussion by going to sbts.edu and look at the bottom of the homepage under Recent Video. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.